Track 1, Manor Park. Who would have lived in a place like this? Who'd have thought that the Duke of Norfolk's son had lived here? They were a proper upper class. All descended from King Edward I, you know. Of course, there's no trace of the grand old house today. Fortunately, we have this image on the panel in front of you. The Howards. That's the family name. The estate was sold in 1925. So Lord Howard packed his bags and went to live in one of his other houses, Arundel Castle in Sussex. Glossop Hall became a school for a while before being knocked down. They've built a housing estate on it now. Today, we're going to spend an hour or so exploring some of his lordship's manor. Not just his private grounds, but the area we now call Old Glossop, the original Glossop. Much of it has been preserved from the late 18th century, when a few bold men realising this area was perfect for making cotton on an industrial scale. With a bit of luck, we'll bump into some local people who can share their knowledge with us too. Now, you're probably wondering what these grounds were like when his lordship was in residence. Let's head out to our next stop to find out. Don't cross a pedestrian bridge over the river. Follow the path up through the car park, minding the traffic, and past the skate park. We'll stop at the panel in front of the ornamental lake. Track 2. Friends in High Places. The old Glossop Hall stood a few stone throws ahead and a little to the left of this former fish pond. Like I say, nothing remains today except the name. The bungalows stand on the appropriately named Old Hall Close and Park Close off Hall Meadow Road. If you've got a phone with you, take a look on Google Maps. A local lady, Miss Bennett, often visited the hall's grounds as a child, when it was still the Howards' private property. I found this quote of hers in a book called I Remember, Reminiscences of Glossop Before the First World War.
My uncle, George Bennett, was a friend of his lordship's head gardener. On Sunday evenings we went over the grounds with the gardener, who took care of plants and flowers, sheds and orchards, to give pleasure to his lordship during his residence. In the little spinney in the back of the house I had a tree swing. After we'd seen all was right in the long wood and meadows, we could see the peacocks. Two were on the front lawn, two black swans were on the big lake, which was very large and deep. A little further past the playgrounds now was a watercress stream, and we gathered cress for tea and tomatoes for the cook at the hall.
She sounds lovely, doesn't she? But she had a mischievous side, as you'll discover at the next stop. Follow the shady tree-lined path between the brook and the pond, walking its full length, and then cross the bridge to enter the rose garden, our next stop. Track 3. The Rose Garden, a scrumper's paradise.
We children would steal the Manor Park orchard fruits. There was a wonderful kitchen garden, a rose and flower garden, a vegetable one and a stream running underneath to water them. We paddled in the stream in the grounds. I always fell in. I used to go home with wet stockings and get sent to bed. Many times my gran would come to church gate in her rustling taffeta silk gown and spotless white apron, a neckerchief blowing, and show me up all the way home when I was late for tea.
See what I mean about Miss Bennett? I bet all that lovely fruit was very tempting to a young child, though. Right, come on. We need to head through the rose garden towards that red brick wall at the far end. His lordship had a fine greenhouse built up against that wall. It was full of exotic fruits, like common folk could only dream of sampling. Imagine grapes, oranges and grapefruit dangling invitingly behind the glass. After passing by the former greenhouse, turn left to cross the river once again. Now keep right and follow the winding path uphill, exiting the park onto Church Close, locally known as Town End. Turn right along Church Walk, the original east-west road through Glossopdale, and follow the public footpath. Our next stop is beside the old Glossop Trail lamppost plaque, between the old Duke of Norfolk School and the parish church. We'll see a few of these plaques during the walk. They provide lovely tidbits of information and old photographs concerning old Glossop. Track 4. The Duke of Norfolk's School. Break the ice first. Well, look who we have here. I'm glad we bumped into you. So, Mrs. Thomason, where's your favourite place in Old Ossip?
The Duke of Norfolk's. The Duke of Norfolk School, the old school.
And why's that, Mrs. Thomason?
Because I worked there for 38 years.
In charge of the infants, weren't you?
Yeah, it was a lovely school.
And from what I've heard, you were very popular. I bumped into one of your former pupils recently and they said you were very strict, but also very pretty. He said we all liked being in Mrs. Thomason's class because she used to tell us off in a nice way. When we knew we'd been told off, we thought we'd better not do that again because we didn't want to upset Mrs. Thomason. He wasn't so flattering about the outside toilets, though. He said in the cold, in the winter, you sometimes had to break the ice in the toilet, and there was a stick at the side of the toilet, and the teacher used to shout to you, "Break the ice first!" There's a picture for you. Moving swiftly on. Thank you, Mrs. Thomason. See you again soon. Let's continue on past the church to arrive on Church Street South. Now cross the road carefully. I've arranged for us to meet Roger Hargreaves from the Glossop Heritage Trust beside the old market cross. Track 5, The Marketplace. Squeezed by early urban sprawl. Thanks for coming down, Roger. There's not much of a marketplace here today, is there?
What you see now of the market area is only a fraction of what there would have been, because it would probably have extended out. The church, the modern church, extends outwards to the east far more than the old one did. The original church was a much smaller building and it sat further back. The tower is in the original position, so the modern church has been extended twice, so it's much, much longer than the original one. So my guess is that the marketplace would once have basically straddled Church Street as it is. It would have been on both sides of Church Street, including part of what's now the churchyard. It would have been a much bigger place. And we know that the present position of the market cross, it only got there in the 1900s. The earliest photographs of it show it sitting against the house at the back of the marketplace.
There's a photo of the cross in its original position on the lamppost plaque to our left. So why did the marketplace shrink, Roger?
Once the traders began to prefer to work from shops rather than open stalls, they would build their houses on the market ground because they had rights there. Yeah. So large market areas, which would have been capable of, you know, holding cattle, these big market areas gradually shrunk as people built houses. And in this case, they built the house right up to the market cross, which would have been in the centre probably, or near the centre.
Take a look at the brass plaque on the cross's base to see how long it has stood here. We'll head up Church Street South now and stop just after number 36, the last building on the right-hand side of the road. Here we'll find the lamppost plaque and local residents Tony and Frank. Track 6, The Bailiff's House. The Howard family inherited the manor of Glossop in 1606, but there wasn't a resident squire for 250 years. So who did his lordship's dirty work? That job fell to the bailiff, or agent, who lived in this 17th century building. He oversaw the lands and buildings of the manor, collected fines and rents, and managed the profits and expenses. You can see this building is clearly bigger than the others. Until it became a private residence in the 1960s, this building served another purpose. Take a look at the photograph on the lamppost plaque. Do you notice anything different? Tony Wright certainly does, don't you?
Because my grandmother remembers it as a child, because she was born in 1893, so she could remember the pigs being killed on that site at the back of the butchers. And I remember the window being boarded, the shop window boarded up. And then, of course, when the boarding was taken down, proper mullion windows were put in.
Yeah.
And it looks like a house now, but it wasn't like that. It was a shop front.
Continue up Church Street South and take a short detour up Dun Lane, the cul-de-sac to the right of the Bull's Head, which is reputedly the oldest inhabited building in Glossop. The second building on the right has some carved motifs and a date stone above the door. What do you think this shop once sold? To find out, return back down the lane and left into Wellgate. Read the interpretation panel opposite the Wheatsheaf pub before we also discover what lies up yonder. Track 7. What lies up yonder? The shop with the carved motifs was another butcher's. They, along with the Romans, Anglo-Saxons, monks, the Howard family and the industrialists all seemed to have prospered here. But not everyone was so lucky, were they, Rita?
When we were little, the tramps used to... We were playing outside and the tramps used to say, can you tell me where the tramp ward is? So yes. I used to see these tramps going up to get to bed and, well, breakfast, you know, food and that, yeah.
So, where were they going? The answer is up yonder, now Shire Hill NHS Hospital. There's a signpost a little further along the road. No one dared to call it by its proper name, the workhouse. Before some tramps went inside, they'd hide what money they did have in the dry stone walls so they could plead poverty. Apparently, the local youth got wind of this and would spend hours trying to find the money. In 1834, workhouses became central to helping those people who were unable to provide for themselves. For the able-bodied, workhouses provided board and lodging in return for work. When the 1881 census was recorded, John and Mary Bealey were overseeing 65 inmates aged between 5 months and 84 years old. 3 were blind, and a further 9 were labelled imbeciles. Whilst many were born in the local area, vagrants from as far as Scotland and Ireland were also resident here. 18 inmates were recorded as having an occupation linked to the cotton industry. You're welcome to wander up yonder. It's about 10 minutes' walk if you follow the signs. Today the piggeries and tramps' wards have gone. In fact, the locals now call it the Shire Hilton, reflecting how much the original buildings have been modernised and extended. I expect the hidden money has long since gone too. Continue down Wellgate and stop beside the lamppost plaque at the top of Wesley Street, a road that has seen a few celebrities. Track 8, Wesley Street. Pajamas, Mount Everest and recording artists. The cottages down the left-hand side of the road were once called Rolfe's Mill. Benjamin Rolfe was the first tenant and his business appears to represent the transition stage between the systems of domestic and factory production, with several families working hand machinery under one roof, rather than in their own homes. Rolfe's enterprise thrived, and soon he had outgrown these buildings. We will visit his second mill at the next stop. Before we leave, take a look at the Wesleyan School opposite, which later became a pyjama factory, didn't it, Frank?
Yeah, a fellow called Jack Merrin made pyjamas for the National Health Service, and he bought that, and then he bought the chapel across the road and moved the business side across the road, and then Mountain Equipment took it over, which was his son, because I was outside one day, and the guy that ran it, Pete Merrin, said, he said, have a word with Joe. He said, he's off to Everest in the morning. I said, Everest? He said, is it okay if he leaves his car out here? And they did a lot of equipment from the Everest expeditions. And I said, yeah, sure it is. And the fellow was called Joe Tasker. And about 3 weeks later, he'd been killed on Everest. Mm. And his car was still outside our house. Mm. The chapel, at one stage, was a mushroom farm.
Later, the chapel became a recording studio.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was. There was a very famous woman, and she turned up with a stretched limo, and it was pouring down with rain, and she was all the minders, you know, come along. And as she got out, she fell, and it was pouring down, and she had all this fancy gear, face down, I have to go home. And I said, we can't, we've booked the studio time, you've got to go in, and she was dripping wet through.
Turn left and follow Wesley Street around to the right into Hope Street. Take the first left and walk to the end of Hawkshead Road to reach an old mill with a tall red brick chimney. Track 9, Hawkshead Mill, an inventor at the heart of Rough Town. James Starkey built the first mill here towards the end of the 18th century. In 1792, it was renamed Hawkshead Mill when Benjamin Rolfe moved his textile business from Wesley Street. By 1895, the much enlarged mill was run by Isaac Jackson, a shoemaker and saddler, who had an eye for innovation. Jackson devised an efficient fastening for mill machinery drive belts and manufactured nuts and bolts. During the First World War, when the mill was used as a munitions factory, Jackson invented a more effective fuse for British artillery shells. The plaque on the wall honours Jackson's men who lost their lives in the First World War. Let's return back to Hope Street, along the track to your right. Hope Street was originally built to house mill workers, but it soon became populated with the quarrymen who worked at Glossop Low Quarries, up on your left. Their reputation went before them, and the area adopted the less than flattering name Rough Town. The name stuck. It was even used officially in census returns, parish records, and in trade directories too. This wasn't a place to be after dark. Back on Hope Street, take a look at the lamppost plaque to the right of the former Greyhound Inn. It has a lovely photo of the fearsome-looking landlady standing outside with her patrons. Turn left along Hope Street and head past a row of modern cottages called High Stones Gardens. Stop opposite Hope Hill Cottage, just before the bend. There's a lamppost plaque to find. Track 10, John Wood, the father of the Glossop Mill Empire. Hope Hill Cottage once belonged to the mill owner John Wood. His first three mills stood on the land to the left of the lamppost plaque. Michael Brown adds some colour to the plaque's image, which appeared on Wood's official letterhead.
There was a row of cottages and a mill, and this is called Barrack Mill. They kept straight out from the end. And what Wood did when he came here from Meltham in 1819, he went to live there, he rented the cottages and he rented the mill. So the water supply comes in down here along the top. It then went into another one because down here was a mill called Water Mill, which he renamed Waterloo Mill, which gives a good clue to when he took it over. Trouble was, it was boom and bust time, so what he did, they often renamed a mill to try and improve the look a little bit, you know. So Waterloo has happened recently, so it's a good name, it's, you know. And then there was another one down here called Threadmill. All you can see of it is a little gateway, but there was another reservoir and a chimney.
Wood went on to bigger and better things, leasing the huge steam-powered mills in Howardtown, now Glossop. In 1833, Mr. Abraham Broadbent took over Threadmill. He made bobbins, hat tips and doubled yarn for hand loom weavers. Every week he travelled to Huddersfield, carrying his work on his back. The following section of the trail route may be unsuitable for people with mobility impairments or young children. If, for example, you're a wheelchair user, you may like to return back to Wesley Street and turn right at the bottom of this road to bring you to stop 11. Otherwise, turn right and head downhill to the bus turning circle, where there's another interpretation panel with information about old Glossop's water power. It also dispels a long-held myth about the Romans. This story can also be found on the oldglossoptrail.co.uk website. Carefully follow the road along the full length of Shepley Street, which has no footpaths as you pass the factory on your right, until you reach the Queen's Arms public house. Track 11, the Queen's Arms. Wet your whistle, and sometimes your feet too. The Queen's Hotel, as it was known then, was a terminus for the electric tram, which opened in 1903. 4 miles of track, weaved its way past the mills between Old Glossop and the Palatine in Hadfield. The last tram ran on Christmas Eve in 1927. We can't be sure how many times the tram was delayed by surface water, but this area has seen its fair share of flooding over the years.
It must have been most flooded building in Glossop, the Queen's.
2000, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a bad one then when cars were swept through Manor Park from the bottom of Wesley Street. It's flooded over 50 years, 10 times.
When Heaney lived at Hawkshead House in 1944, there was a bad flood, and his grand piano ended up in Glossop.
Yeah.
The flood came through it.
The annual Wakes event also ran along Manor Park Road. Coconut shies and other stalls lined the streets. Every house was open and people were welcome to pop inside. The festivities ran on late into the night, giving the event its other name, the Wild Weekend. Follow the road around to the left and look out for two more lamppost plaques just beyond the bridge. Continue along Manor Park Road to reach the gated entrance to Manor Park. Here you will find one last lamppost plaque, and we'll hear from Miss Bennett one final time. Track 12, The Tab. On the opposite side of the road, just a little further down Manor Park Road, stands the former Tabernacle Sunday School, or The Tab. It was an independent chapel that Miss Bennett went to every week without fail.
We were all in the Tabernacle Sunday School on Sunday, and everyone had to give an account of chapel sermon we dare not miss. If we went out before school was over, the secretary, Wilf Jackson, would wait until the service was over, bring out a hymn book and clout us with it, girl or boy. The Tab was a lovely school. We had a top room for parties and socials and Christmas coffee party.
It was also famous for its Christmas carolling.
On Christmas Eve, after the services, the choirs would go round Old Glossop singing and probably not get home until 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning on Christmas morning, because they'd been going around singing to people. Of course, they got a drink at every house. That was in the 1920s, 1930s, you know, and that continued up to the Second War. You know, I can remember my grandmother saying, "Those dreadful men going out on Christmas Eve singing, you know." And they all had to give them a drink when they turned up.
Well, we've almost finished our trail, so I'll bid you farewell. Thanks for your time. To return back to the car park, past the tennis courts on the right and the children's play area on the left.